I would like to draw your attention to one portion of scripture for now and several others as we go along. The scripture I want us to read now is found in Proverbs and chapter 2. It is just one verse. But for the sake of context, I will read a few more. We'll read from verse 10. Our interest is in verse 17. Just a statement from that verse. When wisdom enters your heart and knowledge is pleasant to your soul, discretion will preserve you. Understanding will keep you, to deliver you from the way of evil, from the man who speaks perverse things, from those who leave the paths of uprightness to walk in the ways of darkness, who rejoice in doing evil and delight in the perversity of the wicked, whose ways are crooked, and who are devious in their paths, to deliver you from the immoral woman, from the seductress, who flatters with her words, who forsakes the companion of her youth, and forgets the covenant of her God. I want you to note that statement, the covenant of her God. She forsakes the covenant of her God. And he who allows wisdom to enter into his heart, he will see to it that he is away out of the paths of the immoral woman, out of the paths of he who forsakes the companion of her youth and forgets the covenants of her God. Covenants are present at every level of human existence. You will, for example, find covenants at a personal level. Our brother, Pastor Kayombo, very ably unpacked this aspect of the subject. You will find covenants at the marriage level, at the church level, at the work level, business level, and even at the state level. At the work level, when I am employed, I enter into a covenant relationship with my employees. At the business level, deals are entered into on the basis of covenants. Politically speaking, the government rules in covenant relationship with the people. The rulers swear that they will uphold the constitution of the country and work to promote the well-being of the nation. The people, on the other hand, pledge their allegiance to their government. They pledge to support the government, to pay their taxes, to serve in the army, and so on and so forth. At all these levels, if the pledge is violated, penalties are invoked. That is the nature of covenants. But at no level of our lives does the covenant form touch us so deeply than at the level of marriage. The Bible teaches us that those that become so married cleave together and become one flesh. And precisely for this reason, commitment to this covenant can bring so much blessing, all manner of benefits. And forsaking the covenant will lead to pain, to distress, to disillusionment. One would expect, therefore, that people will tend to invest in the institution of marriage and avoid the breaking of it. Alas, there are many couples who don't. Rather, they invest in what I may term as a proliferation of divorce. They work to undermine the marriage, to destroy it even. Why is that? Well, the Lord in Mark 10 said that it was because of the hardness of heart, which came about obviously because of the sin of Adam. So many enter marriage with good intentions, but before long, the hardness of heart kicks in and begins to influence wrong thinking and to inspire wrong attitudes and intentions. And that leads to the breaking of a covenant. But I also suggest that part of the reason, which of course cannot be divorced from hardness of heart, lies in a failure to understand the idea of covenant. Many think a covenant is just a contract. A contract is a legal agreement between people or even companies, which would normally be binding for a period of time. We have just signed a contract with a new government, and it has a tenure, 5 years. After 5 years, Mr. Hagainde will be seeking a new contract along with his UPND. And there are people who commit themselves to marriage only for a given time, as if it was a contract. But marriage is not a contractual relationship in that sense. Actually, it is meant to be a covenant. And I will in a moment offer a nuanced definition of covenant as distinguished from contract. Proverbs 2 verse 17 and Malachi 2 verse 14 refer to marriage as a covenant. In Proverbs 2 verse 17, which we just read together, God condemns the seductress who forsakes the companion of her youth and the covenant of her God. Marriage here is referred to as the covenant of her God, because, first of all, it is God who ordained marriage. It is God who instituted that covenant. The covenant that she and her husband enters into is not merely an agreement between a man and a woman, but it is also struck with God, who joined them together and who bound them to that covenant, whom they in fact call to witness. Matthew 19 and verse 6 speaks about what God has joined together. Marriage is something God joins together. So it's not just a matter between man and woman, but a matter between man, woman, and God. Therefore, when the seductress, as she is referred to here, the immoral woman forsakes her husband and the covenant that she made with him, she also forsakes the covenant of her God. In Malachi 2 and verse 14, we find God there condemning the man who deals treacherously with what he refers to as his wife by covenant. His wife by covenant. The idea of the wife of thy covenant suggests that marriage is a relationship established by mutual agreement between husband and wife. But they are not the only parties, in a sense. There is, according to Malachi chapter 2 and verse 14, a God who is witness to that covenant. As we think about the marriage covenant, therefore, I would like us to discuss three things. Namely, the definition of the marriage covenant, the elements of a marriage covenant, and the implications of entering into a marriage covenant. Let's begin with the definition of a marriage covenant. Generally speaking, a covenant is a formal and solemn arrangement or agreement which places binding obligations upon the parties to the covenant. A formal, solemn agreement which places binding obligations upon the parties to the covenant. And that definition would ring true to any other kind of covenant. Specifically speaking, the marriage covenant is a formal and solemn agreement or arrangement between a man and a woman to become husband and wife, and this agreement places binding obligations upon them until death parts them. And Romans chapter 7 suggests that the relationship is meant to last until death. Listen to how Paul puts it in Romans 7 and verse 1. Or do you not know, brethren? For I speak to those who know the law, that the law has dominion over man as long as he lives. For the woman who has a husband is bound by the law to her husband as long as he lives. But if the husband dies, she is released from the law of her husband. So then, if while her husband lives she marries another man, she will be called an adulteress. But if her husband dies, she is free from that law, so that she is no adulteress, though she has married another man. That is how the Bible defines a covenant. Let's hurry on and look at the elements of a marriage covenant. And in offering these elements, we are, in a sense, exegeting that definition. The elements of a marriage covenant are as follows. First, it is a formal agreement. It is formal. That means that it is effected according to established rules. These rules involve both ceremony and law. First, it is a ceremony in that it is done according to prescribed tradition or protocol. If you look at the Marriage Act, Zambia Marriage Act, it actually reads that it may be done according to the rites and usages of marriage observed in such a church, if it is done through a church. So there is provision given to that. Identification of the fact that marriage will be celebrated in various settings. And if it is done in the church, it will be done according to the rites and usages of marriage observed in such a church. And every church or denomination will have traditions as to how they order a given marriage ceremony. So it is a ceremony. But secondly, it is legal in that it is done according to the state or civil law. It's a civil relationship. Even when we administer it in the context of the church, ultimately, we are doing it on behalf of the state, on behalf of the registrar of marriages. So it is an agreement that the state provides the framework for, the state guides, the state authenticates, and the state recognizes. I took some time to look at some of the provisions of the laws of Zambia according to the Marriage Act. Here's a snapshot of some of those provisions. I won't go into any detail about that, or just list them. Marriages may be solemnized in any licensed place of worship with open doors between the hours of 6 o'clock in the forenoon and 6 o'clock in the afternoon. Secondly, a minister shall not solemnize any marriage if he knows of any just impediment to such marriage. Thirdly, a minister shall not solemnize any marriage except in a building which has been duly licensed by the government minister. Fourthly, each of the parties must, in the presence of the minister, small m, the big M is the government minister, small m, the church minister, in the presence of such a minister who is acting on behalf of the registrar of societies, he declares as follows. It's interesting that these things are in the law. What exactly must be said? I do solemnly declare that I know not of any lawful impediment why I, so and so, may not be joined in matrimony to so and so. And each of the parties may also say to the other, I call upon these persons here present to witness that I do take thee to be my lawful wedded wife or husband. That's actually law. And then fifthly, the minister or registrar, if you do it at the municipal council, shall recite the declaration and the form of contracting words. So there is a form of contracting words which normally come in the form of vows and promises. I do take you as my lawful wedded husband, forsaking others, all others cling only to thee as long as we both shall live. And the other says that. And other words, vows, and promises. That is also required by the law. It's a contract, or more precisely, a covenant which is consummated via vows and promises. And sixthly, immediately after the solemnization of any marriage by a minister, the officiating minister shall fill in a duplicate in marriage certificate. And that certificate will be signed in duplicate by the minister, by the parties, and by two or more witnesses to the marriage. That's the law. And when that hasn't taken place, it's null and void. It is formal. That's the point we are making. And it is formal and solemn. It's interesting that even if you go to the law, you will find that it is expected to be solemn. When they're exchanging vows, that is not time to be blowing fireworks and doing things like that. It's meant to be a solemn occasion, a formal and solemn occasion, because this is a serious matter. I must go on to say that it is also an agreement between a male and a female. Genesis 2 verse 24. A man shall leave his father and mother, that's a male, be joined to his wife, that's a female, and the two will become one flesh. Biblically speaking, it's not an agreement between a man and a man, or between a woman and a woman. It's an agreement between a man, male, and a woman, female. Fourthly, it is public. Of course, we have referred to that in passing. But it is public in the sense that this is not something the parties to the covenant do just between themselves in some little corner in private somewhere. Rather, it is something done publicly. Well, first of all, God must be there as a witness, according to Malachi 2 and verse 14. Parents must be there to witness. And God in Genesis 2 gives us an example of that. He created Adam and then he created Eve. He was there for their parent. He instituted marriage and he officiated at that first marriage ceremony, so to say. He was a witness to him, to it himself. He became the model for how things must be done thereafter. And so we read in Genesis 2 and verse 24, therefore, a man must leave his father and mother. There is a father and mother involved somewhere. And be joined to his wife. And the two will become one flesh. Parents are involved. The state requires legal witnesses. The parties to the covenant must agree and append their signatures to that agreement. But witnesses too, two or more, must sign. Why is it important to have witnesses to sign documents which make covenants? Several reasons. Not least the fact that our lives often depend on the trustworthiness of our commitments. And if we truly mean what we say, if we truly mean to make the promises we make, we should be prepared to make them in the presence of other dignified, trustworthy people. Another reason is that human history has demonstrated, if nothing else, that people do not always keep their promises to protect man from his own fallen nature. God requires witnesses and sanctions to any breaches to that covenant. And so they make promises in front of authorities. And that gives weight to the promises, to the agreements they make. It's public. Fifthly, it is usually signified by a token. We see that from the divine covenants, the biblical covenants. The covenant between God and Noah, for example, it was made and then signified by a rainbow. As long as the rainbow appears, God, he is saying that he will be indicating by that symbol or sign that he will never destroy the world in the manner that he did. The marriage covenant must also be signified by a token. The token is not prescribed. It's left to various cultures to determine. And these days, more often than not, we use a ring. The ring is indicative of commitment. As often as the spouses look at that, they are reminded of the promises they made to each other. But I must also say, in the sixth place, that it is a mirror of the covenant relationship Christ has with his church. It's a sign of sorts of the relationship between Christ and his church. The relationship between Christ and his church was made in eternity, as we were reminded last night. Your marriage is a picture of that. Your marriage is an expression of that. And Ephesians chapter 5, verse 29 through to 31 expresses that. Let me hurry on and speak about the implications of a marriage covenant. If this is what a covenant is, a marriage covenant, what are the implications arising therefrom? There are several. First, marriage is not a casual alliance or a temporary experiment. It is a bond, a holy bond, permanently cemented by a commitment. Genesis 2 and verse 24, if you were using the KJV, uses the word cleave. A man shall leave his father and mother and cleave or be joined to his wife. And that joining emphasizes the fact that there is a cleaving there, a permanent cleaving. And you cannot attempt to put that asunder without causing injury, great injury to the one or the other party or both. And this is expressed in the pledge of troth or loyalty or faithfulness, which we often begin with when we are conducting marriages as ministers. We always ask, don't we, will you have this man to be your lawfully wedded husband or wife? Will you love him or her, forsaking all others and cling only to him as long as you both shall live? We refer to that as the pledge of troth. And when I am preparing people for marriage, I don't leave that out. It's part of the counseling. I want them to understand what that means. Because so many go and stand before God and before the people of God and before their legal witnesses and say those words without meaning them. And yet they are so important and so deep, so serious. Will you do it? I have never been in a ceremony where anyone said, I won't. Everyone says, I do. Do you realize what you are saying when you are saying those words? You are saying, you will be faithful. You are pledging faithfulness to this bond, this lifelong bond. Biblically, covenants are defined as bonds in blood. And usually a sacrifice would be offered where an animal is slain. Blood is issued. And what are they saying when they do that? That they'll be faithful to this promise to a point of shedding blood. They will be, and they are willing to make a commitment to blood to a point where they can die for it, even if it's painful, even if it means shedding blood. They will be willing to do it in order to show their loyalty, their commitment to the pledge they have made. It's not a casual alliance. It's not a temporary experiment. It's a holy bond, permanently cemented. Secondly, marriage is a promise. Ultimately, that's what covenants are. It's a promise you make. It's a promise you commit yourself to keeping for life. In a contract, you promise to keep it for a time. 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years. Well, this is a promise you make until death parts you. What exactly do you promise? Well, first you promise to love. And if the love you have in question is what we often refer to as romantic love, you are in trouble, my friend. Because that love is fleeting. That love is up and down. That love even disappears sometimes. Is it not true that you no longer love your spouse? Romantically, I mean. And you're not making a promise necessarily to do that. And I'm not saying it's important to have that. It's not important to have that. But you're promising to love the agape way. When Ephesians 5 commands husbands to love their wives, it is commanding them to love in this agape way. When 1 Corinthians 13 and verse 4 says love does not fail, it is saying agape does not fail. And someone has defined agape in this way. And those of you that attend Lusaka Baptist Church, you have heard this definition before, no doubt. Love is a gracious and principled disposition of goodwill which goes out of its way to promote the welfare of another, even at personal cost. A gracious and principled disposition of goodwill. It's gracious because it's God-given. It's principled because it is not at the whims of your feelings, your emotional complexion. It's not about how you feel. It's a principle. It's a principled disposition. And it's a disposition to do good to another, to do good to your spouse. And that good is spelled out in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 4 to 8. Love. What does it look like? Listen. Love suffers long and is kind. Love does not envy. Love does not parade itself. Is not puffed up. Love does not behave rudely. Does not seek its own. Is not provoked. Thinks no evil. Does not rejoice in iniquity, but rejoices in the truth. Bears all things. Believes all things. Hopes all things. Endures all things. Love never fails. That's what you're promising to do. And you do need to ask yourself, do you love like that? It's a promise to love. Secondly, it's a promise to be faithful. It's a promise to maintain the honor of the marriage by keeping the terms of the commitment. It's a vow to keep the promise, to keep the marriage intact, regardless of the circumstances of the marriage. It's a commitment not to depend on good health or money or good circumstances. Those are welcome blessings and we must seek them. But there will also be times of sickness and poverty. Difficult circumstances will come. Certainly, what the Lord refers to as the hardness of heart, it will be there. Your wife or husband will sometimes be cantankerous. Your husband or wife will sometimes be impossible. But you committed yourself. You promised. You promised to be faithful, even in those circumstances. It's a promise to stick to each other, no matter what happens. No matter what your heart is telling you, there are people whose hearts tell them that this is the right thing to do. To be unfaithful to your spouse, they say, is the right thing to do. To divorce your spouse is the right thing to do. And in your foolishness, you go along with your own heart and you counsel yourself to think and to say, it feels right. It may feel right, but that doesn't make it right. You made a promise to stick in sickness and health, for better, for worse, for health, for richer, for poorer, until death parts you. And you make those vows willingly, on your own, and you call God and the church to come and witness, to come and hear you say that. You owe it to God. You owe it to the people you call to come and witness. You owe it to your spouse to keep that promise. This is why marital infidelity is such a serious sin. Marital infidelity. Which is expressed in adultery. Can cut at the heart of the marriage covenant. It can violate the deepest part of your commitment. Fourth thing, by way of implications, is that often in the covenant, you even exchange rings. And the ring serves as a witness. Now that is like a fifth witness, isn't it? You have God, you have parents, you have the congregation, you have the legal witnesses. Well, now you have the ring. Serves as a witness. A memorial. Sometimes worrying when spouses take off their rings. They never wear them anymore. Now, if that is a function of doing well in your body, you know, you're growing in size and the ring can no longer fit, that's understandable. But if you are taking it off, or you are taking off whatever the token is, because you are no longer committed to your covenant, there is a problem there, isn't there? Imagine God removing the sign He put there to signify His covenant with Noah. What would He be saying? Not just to Noah, but to humanity. That He is going to destroy the world again with the flood. When you take off your ring, or whatever the sign is, you are saying you are going to destroy, to violate the covenant. You will no longer love. You will no longer be faithful. Is that what you are saying? Let me end by saying the covenant, first of all, is more than just a contract. It is more than just a contract. It's an agreement for life. But remember too that it's an agreement in which God has a part. It's the covenant of your God. Because God made marriage, and God is a witness to every marriage relationship. He was a witness to your marriage. You must therefore take your covenant seriously. Secondly, we are reminded in Ecclesiastes 5, verse 4 to 5, that when you make a vow to God or before God, do not delay in fulfilling it. Do not delay. He has no pleasure in fools. Solomon says, fulfill your vow. It is better not to make a vow than to make one and not fulfill it. There will be consequences. And if you are not fulfilling your vows and promises, what makes you think that when you stand before Christ at the last day to make an account, to give an account of the deeds you have done in your body, including how you have conducted your marriage, that you will not be answering questions about that before your master? I guarantee that you will. Another point I want to end with is that the witnesses you call, God, the most important witness there, your parents or guardians, your brethren, your legal witnesses, they all take you seriously. They all take you seriously. They don't come to be taken for a ride. They say, come, everyone. And here are the promises I must make to this man or woman. And they take it seriously. It's not a game. How dare you call witnesses only to break your covenant a few months later or a few years later. What are you going to say to these witnesses? That you were not serious? Or that you really didn't mean what you were saying? Or you didn't understand the implications of what you were saying? Or that, oh, you thought she will continue to look beautiful. He will continue to be handsome. You didn't anticipate the circumstances that have just developed. Is that what you will say? The witnesses take you seriously. And then finally, marriage covenant is intended by God. Remember, we don't make marriage. We didn't bring about the institution of marriage. God did. And it's intended by God to be a lifelong relationship, exemplifying unconditional love, reconciliation. Things will not always go easy. You will sin against each other. You will hurt each other. You need to forgive each other. Reconciliation, sexual purity, growth. People can negotiate themselves out of contracts, but not out of covenants. A marriage covenant is meant to last until death. I'll end here. May God bless these words to our hearts and to our lives, to our marriages if we are married. Amen.